Very well. We'll go on to the next and final case of the day, which is State versus Strickland. And both counsel are present in the courtroom and I think are familiar with our protocol. Mr. Pivovar, you may approach and you may proceed when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name's Greg Pivovar and I'm for the appointing counsel for Derek Strickland. As you heard in the prior argument, these cases were tried together. Never should have been tried together, but I can't deal with that now. As you heard in the prior argument from the state, Mr. Newman's cell phone records put him at a tower right under the murder scene about the time of the murder. One of Mr. Strickland's alibi witnesses, which wasn't really looked at by his counsel, was his cell phone records, which placed him 4.9 miles away from the scene at the time of the murder. We didn't pick the time of the murder. The state established the time of the murder at 12:30, 12:34.
We have a range of the murder time, is that correct?
Roughly, Gutierrez says he got there at 12:15, I believe.
11:15?
I thought it was 12:13.
Okay.
But even with the range, the state argued consistently during the entire trial in opening, closing, that this murder occurred at 12:30. I didn't pick that. They picked it. They established that. They argued it. They argued it extensively in closing. My client's cell phone was at the Fort Omaha exit to the North Freeway at 12:34, and then further records establish that he proceeded north from there. There, his next bounce was off of Kentucky Fried Chicken, I believe, and then further north. We're allowed to go forward on alibi and another issue, but I think alibi certainly the stronger issue. Mr. Strickland directed his counsel to interview several alibi witnesses. His counsel consistently indicated to him that he was going to interview these witnesses. Those witnesses were all deposed and, except for in passing, were never asked anything by Mr. Jorgensen about the form of their alibi and what they could testify to that day. He was in a position where he trusted his counsel. His counsel, who I deposed, did not have his records or anything with him at the time of the deposition because it was in the Douglas County Jail where he was a resident at the time. So he had only what he called consistently, I have a vague recollection of this. I have a vague recollection of that. He was asked about all these witnesses. He was asked what kind of strategy it was to abandon the alibi. There was no strategy in abandoning the alibi. He hadn't investigated it. That's borne out by the procedure in the case. Shortly, with 15 days to go before he needed to give notice of alibi, which had not been given, there was a motion to sever, at which time in his unfiled motion to sever, which he subsequently identified in his deposition that he'd authored that and meant to file, he thought it was filed, he mentions that the alibis are very important, but that the alibi of his client might be inconsistent with Mr. Newman's. And therefore, that was a strong reason which to sever the case. So he was aware of the alibi on that day, even though he had never interviewed the three witnesses that we ended up deposing. He then, at no time, files a notice of alibi. He had no time, according to Mr. Strickland's deposition, he had no time confronted him or talked to him about the alibi, gave him any indication that he had interviewed any of the witnesses, only that they would be called to trial. They were all at, in their depositions, they were all at trial ready to testify at the time of trial. They all say, yeah, we were outside the courtroom waiting to testify. Mr. Jorgensen had not even at that time indicated that he might be foreclosed from bringing forth the alibi because of the failure, although that can be remedied in extreme situations too. You can ask for leave of the court to present alibi even though you didn't give 30 days notice of it. My client's in a position where he was never consulted about the trial strategy, and that's clear because there was no trial strategy. There was no discussion with any of the witnesses about their testimony. Their testimony was Hashim, his pseudo stepson is what I call him. He was his girlfriend's son. Hashim said that, yeah, they went downtown, which his cell phone records bear out that he was downtown all pretty much all morning from about 9 o'clock to at least 11, 10 something, I think, that he was down there and using his cell phone. Hashim testified they got the haircut. He thought it was about 11 o'clock. Derek thought it was more like 10 o'clock. But both of them put the end time. Derek says 10 o'clock takes about 2 hours to cut both their hair. Hashim said 11 o'clock, we were down about 12. So that puts them, according to Hashim's testimony, downtown at noon. And then at 12:34, they're on the Fort Omaha exit. So you have Hashim testifying to that. And he also testified that he was with Derek that entire time till 12:34 plus.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Pivovar. Are you, with in the interest of time, are you going to address what is it Daryl and Anton may or may not have said that would have been useful?
Yeah, Daryl was going to testify that he was at the place that Mr. Strickland arrived at 1 o'clock, shortly before 1 o'clock. Daryl remembers the time because he was going to a movie, and he was, so the time was established. He needed to be at the movie at 1:30-ish or so. And so Daryl was going to corroborate that Mr. Strickland arrived with Hashim at sometime around between 12:30 and 1 o'clock. The girlfriend was going to establish more or less that Hashim was with him when he left and with him later in the day when she picked up Hashim from him. So she was going to corroborate, not necessarily the times, but the coming and going. Hashim was with Daryl the entire time. The trial court rested on the fact, or put part of their eggs in the basket, that their times didn't exactly match. I, for one, as a trial attorney, don't like my witnesses' testimony to sound like it came from the same script. They were honest. They were trying to remember something that happened 8 years ago. Their times don't match, but they're corroborated by the cell phone records. Those cell phone records tell you as much. And what's important there is his counsel did not ask one question of the cell phone expert. And those cell phone records were put in by the state, and then nobody used them. Nobody used them to establish anything. But they were there, even though Mr. Jorgensen didn't put them in, they were there.
Mr. Pivovar, your time has expired. Justice Miller Lerman, did you want to follow up on your question, or does any other member of the court wish to follow up?
If I may, with respect to a potential cell phone expert, what was it that expert would have said favorable to your client?
Well, I believe the testimony would have been along the lines that 1234 and pinging off that tower means he was within so many feet of that tower, so many blocks or whatever. But we wanted that testimony to establish what those pings mean and why his cell phone might have been not used between, I think there was about an hour and a half period where it was not used while it was downtown. So we wanted that expert to help us with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another question?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Ms. Tangeman, you may approach and proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm Erin Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. I intend to focus once again on the trial counsel's failure to present an alibi defense and the district court's denial of post-conviction relief on that ground. I want to start, I think, with the cell phone records. Part of the alibi claim is that his alibi is valid because the cell tower used for this call at 12:34 p.m. Was not near the crime scene. Now, the state, first of all, Strickland's testimony, and I believe it's also argued in this brief, that this 12:34 call was a call that he made on his way to a friend's house, which is where he stopped before he went to his grandmother's house. But this is not true. There was a call at 12:34, but the trial testimony, which is in the record, was an incoming call, and that call was routed to voicemail. The cell phone records completely contradict the argument made in brief and the argument Strickland himself testified to. The next two phone calls after 12:34 p.m. were also sent straight to the voicemail. There were also no text messages either to Strickland's phone or from Strickland's phone, which he claims he was sending at this time he was driving to his grandmother's house after the barbershop. Strickland did not make a phone call again until he called Newman on his second phone number at 2:15 p.m. Strickland's testimony regarding the time frame of that day is also not credible because he had no explanation for these multiple phone calls he had with Newman on the day of the murders. They called each other seven times between, I think it was 9:27 and roughly 11:15 a.m. He denied speaking to Newman at all and claimed that it was Newman's girlfriend that he was talking to. But she testified at trial that the phone number in question here, that phone, she bought specifically for Newman, and that she never used that phone. It was Newman's phone. She had just purchased it for him. And then regarding his claim that the alibi was valid because back to the cell phone tower not being at the crime scene, or excuse me, the theory is that because this 2:34 call bounced off a cell phone tower that was not near the crime scene, 1234, excuse me, that it means he was not at the murder scene, we disagree. The evidence showed that Morales last answered his phone, and that was at 12:15 p.m. when Herrera, Gutierrez, and Noriega arrived at the shop. Based on that testimony, the testimony of Herrera Gutierrez at the trial, the shooting occurred very shortly after they arrived with the cocaine because Strickland and Newman were already present. As soon as they went to open the cocaine, the guns were grabbed, the shots were fired. Things moved very quickly. So it is plausible that Strickland fled immediately after the murders and was away from the crime scene by 12:34 p.m. The 12:36 p.m. time that's mentioned throughout the defendant's brief, and I believe in some of this court's prior opinions, has to do with Newman's phone. There was a 12:36 call still at the auto body shop tower. But we don't know if Newman and Strickland were together, if they were separate, but it's completely plausible that Strickland was away from the crime scene by 12:34 p.m. Furthermore, the jury at trial was aware that the cell phone records established this 12:34 call from a cell phone tower that was nowhere near the crime scene. Defense counsel did argue this to the jury at trial, and the state believes there's nothing in the testimony of these alleged alibi witnesses that would strengthen that claim. So we think the district court did correctly find that trial counsel was not deficient regarding the alibi witnesses given the phone records in and of themselves. Now, regarding the witnesses that...
How would the testimony of the Mr. Pivar referred to as the pseudo-stepson, would the testimony about them being downtown and the haircuts, how would that not bolster the evidence regarding the 12:34?
I think it could in a certain, like, I think if you look at the son's testimony that we got there at 11, that yes, could, if you look at that in isolation. But the problem here is the district court was presented with multiple witnesses who said various differing things. Strickland himself, that it testified much earlier, and the district court chose that time frame because that time frame was confirmed by the cell tower records from Strickland's phone that was in trial. Regarding the after the haircut, they went to the grandmother's house. The son never testified to that. He does not remember doing that. He said they went home. The brother testified. He does not remember Strickland being with anybody when he showed up at the grandmother's house that day. And so, while yes, it's not always going to be perfect, but there's big gaps, and no one directly shows where Strickland was at that time period that the murders occur. Also, regarding the brother's testimony that Strickland showed up at the house shortly before 1 p.m., which, given the time of the murders, he may, but I think there's something in the testimony that makes the brother's testimony not credible or mistaken. He talked about he knows he left before 1 o'clock because he was going to the movies. But he also said before he left that his aunt came out and told everybody that Morales had been murdered. Morales and Noriega's bodies were not found until well after 2 o'clock. So there is no way at 1 o'clock he was told that the murders had happened. So if Strickland had in fact showed up at the grandmother's house, as the brother had testified, it happened well after the time frame that he testified to.
If I may turn to the potential of prejudice with respect
yes.
to calling, not calling alibi witnesses, could you address the legal standard?
Yes. So the state believes that the district court correctly found that there is not a reasonable probability that Strickland would have been acquitted if these witnesses would have testified at trial. Like Newman's case, we have eyewitness testimony from Herrera Gutierrez that was corroborated by physical evidence, that was corroborated by the cell phone records. He was familiar with both men. This is not a case of he showed up and he did not know who these people were, and so Strickland was guilty by his association with Newman. He had seen Strickland multiple times in the past. He just did not know his name because names were never exchanged during those time periods. I think once we go again to Strickland having no explanation for the multiple phone calls to Newman and Newman's phone calls then with Morales and Strickland not turning his phone back on until later. And then the next call once again to Newman. And I think when you couple all of that together, there is no reasonable probability that given what these alibi witnesses could have testified to, that he would have been acquitted. There are two additional assignments of error. I do not intend to address either of those. I think they are adequately addressed on briefs, but if this court has any questions, I would entertain those.
Unlike Newman, is there anything in the record in this case to show that trial counsel reasonably investigated the alibi defense or discussed the potential abandonment of it with his client?
I will say the testimony of trial counsel in this case varies greatly from the testimony of trial counsel in Newman's case. Trial counsel in this case did not have the ability to look at his notes beforehand. His memory was very fuzzy. So he did testify to certain things. He does remember making a decision not to use an alibi. He does remember talking to some of the alibi witnesses. He does remember having discussions with Strickland, but I will agree they're very vague. And I think what the district court did in this case, took his conclusions, what he remembers concluding, and looked at the evidence presented to see if that was valid based on the evidence presented to her at the district court hearing. We ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Any other questions? Hearing none, we have no rebuttal time, correct?
Yes.
Very well. The appeal is submitted and the court is adjourned and counsel are excused. Thank you very much. And Mr. Pivovar, thank you for your service as appointed counsel.